Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you're a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us. We're here for our debut of our fifth season.
I know, shocking.
It's crazy we're still here 5 years later.
I was slightly tempted to just like yell out, "Good morning, Vietnam," like Michael Scott style, but...
And everyone's like, crickets, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, they're like, that movie's so old, we don't get the reference.
We don't get the reference. Well, I do, and I think that would have been hysterical.
Well, okay, well, so let's start over. Yeah, but we are here in the morning once again. This seems to be our norm now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm under caffeinated and talking gibberish, basically. I'm like, what's happening? This morning earlier, I was trying to think of the movie Black Panther, and I couldn't remember. I was like, black superhero.
But black the one.
Wakanda?
One.
Nope, that's wrong. Black, the movie with a very... black people of color cast.
The very black people. You know.
People of color cast.
The movie that people only had suits. White people from Tolkien movies.
He had a lot of technology. I don't, like, it took me a full 5 minutes.
That's rough. And nobody in your household helped you?
No, they're all messing with me.
That's messed up.
They're like, Doctor Strange. I was like, shut up. No, no, no.
Oh, my God.
I hate you. And then Victor was like, The Hobbit.
Like, get you out. You asshole.
Get out. Okay, so we're here to talk about the first Purge.
The Ridge.
That was released in 2013. Mm-hmm. It's in honor of Inauguration Day. I'm just going to say it.
Yep, we'll just put it out there tomorrow.
That's going to be the norm.
Tomorrow is Inauguration Day.
Yeah, so take that with whatever.
For what you will.
What it's worth.
Yeah.
Everyone who knows me knows how I feel.
And if you don't, by the end of this episode, you will.
You can get I'm guessing. Now.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
You're in or you're out, I guess.
We don't have sponsors.
We sure don't. So. We're not beholden to anyone except each other
Truth. And the truth. How about those drones in New Jersey? Am I right?
Oh, my God. No, no.
Okay. So we haven't seen each other in a month. It's been a long time.
Yes, it has been a long time.
What is new with you?
Well, I mean, obviously, the holidays. The holidays were what they were. They were... nice and low-key and peaceful around our house. A little bit of family, a lot of food, a lot of drinking. My slightly dramatic son, who is almost 18 and will be going to college in the fall, referring to it as his last childhood Christmas.
Oh, my God.
Which I didn't need to be reminded of. but thanks, kid. And, but now, like, that was so long ago. Like, it's already late-ish January.
I know.
And I'm just drinking more water. As you can see, I got this lovely cup as a Christmas gift from Tom.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah,
cute.
It's really cute. It's sold by... there's a small business roastery and coffee company in San Francisco called Andytown. And there's actually two on Terravel Street, one really close to, like, just a couple blocks from our house, and then one down at the beach. And it's funny because the one closest to our house is actually their roastery site. Mm-hmm. And so when they're roasting, the entire neighborhood smells like burnt toast. And you're like, oh, there goes Andytown. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they have like really cute, you know, T-shirts and sweatshirts, and they do projects with they've done projects with San Francisco, which is like my favorite clothing brand. Mm-hmm. And so Tom got me this little, like, it's an insulated tumbler for our listeners who can't see it, with like a rigid straw. And I was like, all right, let's do this. Let's do water. And
let's do water.
Let's do water. And it's funny because, you know, it's a joke amongst teachers, and it's been in some of the funny reels you've shared on Instagram. I'm like, we're teachers. We all have UTIs because as
of course I always have a bladder infection. Yeah. We're teachers.
And I think that that's something that people who've never worked in that field, like, maybe don't know or can't really grasp the reality of not being able to go to the bathroom whenever you need to.
Yeah.
And it's like
the popping by to a classroom next door, like, hey, can you watch me? I really have to pee. I cannot wait for recess. I gotta go.
You gotta go.
And I then just drank too much coffee.
At recess, like, we have, you know, like, in our school building, the adult bathrooms are limited to one toilet upstairs and one toilet downstairs. And so, like, in the 15 minutes of recess that we have, we're all trying to get through using the same toilet. And it's never really been a big problem for me because I'm a little bit of a camel and I used to really not drink that much water during the day. And so,
but like, who cares about my kidneys?
I know, right? My hydration. But now that I'm like drinking more, I'm like, oh, fuck. Now I'm one of these people that's like,
I'm a pee pee pant. I have doing a pee pee pants. Dance and running to the bathroom.
And so we do have an aide for, you know, one aide for fifth grade, one aide for sixth grade. The sixth grade aide, her workspace is in the other sixth grade classroom, and she's virtually never in my room or doing anything for me. But now occasionally I'm like sending a chat to like the other sixth grade teacher being like, is she in there? Can she come stand in here for? And my classroom is right next door to the upstairs adult bathroom. And so I'm like out of the room for like 60 seconds.
Because you don't wash your hands.
I don't. I lick them clean.
That's for losers.
Back in the classroom to build my immune system.
Like a cat.
And it's rough because I feel like last year I had a much better class last year, just to put it plainly. And so in an emergency, if I knew all I had to do was pee and it was going to be like 1 minute and they were working on something.
No one would be hanging off the ceiling.
Right.
When you
I could
back.
Just like, and you don't tell them you're stepping out. So like half of them don't even ever notice
they
you ever left.
They never notice. Yeah.
And they don't have enough time to actually get into any trouble. But the class I have now, like I did that earlier in the year, like stepped down to the classroom next door to like ask a question. And when I came back, one student had another student in a headlock in the front of the classroom. Like they were in their desks
really?
When I left, and they're like full on cage match wrestling in the front of the room when I got back less than a minute later.
That's
so like, that's not an option with this group.
No.
So that's my life now, is managing bathroom trips.
There's diapers. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I already do that.
Incontinence.
Yeah, but I can't afford to, like, triple my diaper budget.
Diaper budget. Oh, my goodness.
But, yeah, that's
I understand the struggle.
That's what's new with me.
Tricky.
What's new with
just
you?
Just, like, the minutia of being in education.
Oh, yeah.
We have all the other issues, too. Budget, and it's just
going to... Bosses and coworkers.
And it's just going to get worse, too. Well, more for me, public school, than you. Yeah, I guess. Do you guys get any kind of federal funding? I don't actually know the answer to that question.
No, we're fully funded by the Archdiocese and our tuition and fundraising and things like that.
Got it. Yeah.
Although it is unfortunate because there are elements that the Archdiocese does not fund and expects the school to provide funds for, including like our building is one of quite a few in San Francisco that is well overdue for an earthquake retrofit. Because it was built in 1948.
It's waiting for the big one.
Yeah.
And then after you'll fix it.
Exactly. But that's the thing, is that they won't, the Archdiocese won't approve expenditures for any other facilities projects until the retrofit is complete.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like our paint is peeling, our rugs are stained, our gym roof was leaking. The gym roof got fixed because the gym building for some reason is determined it's a parish building, because on the side of our school we have the school building and then we have a separate building that is where kindergarten TK extended care is. But then on the same piece of property in the city is also the parish center, the church, and the rectory, and mm-hmm. then the gym.
Yeah.
And so some of them are parish buildings and some of them are school buildings. The gym is technically a parish building.
Right.
So, but we can't do any work on school buildings until the school fundraises enough, the millions of dollars from the community that it needs to complete this project.
It would take like a donor who like... They willed all of their estates.
Well, and that's what they were digging for,
like that.
Because this year...
Am I wrong? I mean, that sort of seems like the angle, right?
Yeah, and they were going for that. I think it was last year was our 75th anniversary as a school, right? Yeah, 1948, 2023. Mm-hmm. And so they did this big event because we had done a 70th anniversary event. And then they did a big 75th anniversary event where they invite all the alumni back and everything. And it was basically like
your checkbook.
They were launching what they were calling the capital campaign to try and get the money for this earthquake retrofit.
Did that even come close?
I actually, since I'm not on the parent board anymore,
you don't really know.
I don't know what they actually pulled in, but I know there hasn't been any announcement of even starting to put plans in place or looking at contractors or anything like that. So I think they've still got a ways to go, which is rough on like a day like, you know, that Friday the 10th where we had 3 earthquakes centered a mile from the school in one morning.
Yeah.
And it's like, crazy. This is fun. Let's spend all day looking at the USGS website.
You're like, when's the big one?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And it's bizarre because you can tell that the school is not built the way it should be for earthquakes because some of the smaller ones, or if they're just centered further away, like you'll feel them on one half of the building and not the other. Mm-hmm. So like all the classrooms on the right side of the hallway are ducking and covering, and all the classes on the left side of the hallway are going out business as usual because they didn't feel it.
They
and
didn't
I was
notice.
Like, there's something wrong with this building.
We'll get a class on the part that's not shaking.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, we're on the second floor,
right?
Which is not ideal for earthquakes. But when we had the tsunami warning, it was nice because I was like, we're perfectly positioned to be safe from a if, you know, obviously by the time it got to San Francisco, it was not even noticeable. Like you couldn't tell when it arrived because it was it had lost all of its energy. But the idea that, you know, and we had a bunch of parents freak out, especially because like a lot of public schools were like beholden to evacuate, especially Pacifica because mm-hmm. they're closer to the water than we are.
We all had to evacuate, even our school, which is like, I know this has turned into a tsunami, like school.
Natural disaster podcast.
Even if this wave went over, if a wave went over the mountain, all of Pacifica would be wiped out.
Yeah.
You know, so they were evacuating Ortega, our school, for no reason, basically, because it seemed to me like it was more of a problem to get parents like rushing, trying to get to their kids on Highway 1, right next to the ocean.
Putting more people at risk.
Than actually being helpful in any way.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. And for us, we had, we didn't evacuate because there was never any guidance to do so for, you know, where we were. And the communication was sent to the parents. The situation was being monitored. Right now we're, you know, we're staying put. And there were parents obviously that showed up to pick up their kids anyway, which totally within their right to do. But some of them were like furious and like verbally abusive to our principal for not taking it quote more seriously.
People are damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Well, and the funny thing is, because then we were talking about at the faculty meeting the following week, and our principal pointed out, like, technically our tsunami evacuation site in our neighborhood is closer to the ocean than our school building. It's like the roof of this other school that is 2 blocks closer to the ocean than our school.
Well, that seems
and so it's like with bad. The And I mean, obviously,
it seems
the
like
parent,
it's something that needs to be revisited.
Yeah. And people that just aren't really paying attention to the actual, nobody pays attention to actual facts anymore, information. Because we had parents that were still coming to pick students up after it had already passed.
Yeah. Like at 2 o'clock.
Yeah. Because like it was supposed to quote unquote hit San Francisco at like 12:08 or something.
Yeah.
And their parents coming at like 1 o'clock to pick their kids up. It's
yeah. Like the danger has passed.
Yeah, there was no danger, and B, if
there was
whatever was going to happen is behind us. Mm-hmm. And I had one student whose mom picked him up, but then brought him back, and I was like, okay, good for you, like thanks.
Yeah,
That's less stuff that I have to. But then there were other students. I think I got like 6 kids in my class out of 29 picked up and taken. He was the only one that came back. And then the other kids are like freaking out because they're seeing their classmates getting taken away. Like this is a dangerous situation.
That kid's mom loves him more.
Yeah. And they're like, we're getting left here to die while these kids are going to live. And I'm like, no, their parents are just alarmists.
They just want to freak out.
And then when we were like resuming lessons like the next day, and they would be like, when did we do that? I was like, you know, when you got your mini vacation because your parents were scared of the water, that's when we did this. So you're going to have to make it up on your own.
Yeah. Google it.
Yeah.
That's
what you guys are going to do for the rest of your lives anyway.
Yeah. That's fine. Okay. So
what's new with Meredith?
We had holidays. It was like very, very busy. I think we had house guests in some capacity from the beginning of December up until last week.
Wow.
So, I'm an introvert, and I've had plans every weekend, people around me nonstop until I was unconscious.
Yeah.
So I was like hanging by a thread for a while because I was like annoyed at everybody. Yeah. And I had to explain, like, you all know who I am. I'm not trying to be a bee.
But yeah, this is not personal.
This is just like me needing some bodily autonomy, some hearing.
Oh, well, if you like bodily autonomy, you might want to get out.
Get out of America. I can't get out of California, at least. Well, for now, knock on wood. But I mean, it was still really a lot of fun. So even though I was kind of like a little bit, it was cool to hang out with Victor's family down south. There was a lot of games that they do, and they have really good food and all that stuff. And then the kids had a blast. I mean, there's really not anything, you know, bad to say.
Yeah.
Let's see. I think that's about it. I got super sidetracked by our tsunami talk.
Forgot everything I was going to say.
Everything I want to say. Yeah. Anyway, so let's talk about The Purge.
The Purge. Okay. So The Purge is, as Meredith mentioned, the first one came out in 2013, starring Ethan Hawke, who, you know, has gone on to make some of our other favorite horror movies since.
He's one of my favorites.
Yeah, Sinister is always in my top one. Black Phone I really liked, too.
Me, too. He was so good at being just unsettling. So scary.
Yeah, because he was the hero in Sinister. He was, you know, he was the good guy. He was
misguided a little bit, but yeah, sure. Yeah.
To being the scary thing in Black Phone. But if I'm not mistaken, this was like kind of his first horror project.
I think so. He done in a lot of other movies where there's kind of like dramatic or romance.
Yeah.
Like Reality Bites or Until Sunset or whatever. Those three movies. Before Sunset.
Before Sunrise, after Sunrise.
Yeah, I don't know. Sunrise, Sunset movie. But he's always been like a fun actor to follow his career.
Yeah, definitely. And then Lena Headey, who... from Game of Thrones. Well, and I came to Game of Thrones late. So I actually don't know. I don't know when Game of Thrones started. Like what year?
It started the year I moved out here. So that was 2012. About.
Okay. So she was already. So she might have gotten this role because she had already started. Like she was recognized from maybe a season or two of Game of Thrones.
I mean, I'm fairly certain because I was watching it. I always kind of remember things based on like
your pregnancies,
the kids.
Yeah, because you're
like,
pregnant with Deke.
Who was I pregnant with? Like, not that there's been many, but there's been two important ones.
They were perfectly timed.
Yeah. And then like what I'm doing in my life. So then if I watch something that I'm like, oh yeah, that's where we were just moving it to the Bay Area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So definitely when I first saw this, I didn't know her from Adam. But now obviously going back and watching it since and being, just loving Game of Thrones. It's always fun to see her in a different character and as a brunette.
Oh, I'm kind of right. 2011.
Okay. So she was definitely like a recognizable, like, you know, probably beloved to hate actress out there. Thanks to Game of Thrones.
She's the worst. I love her.
Yeah. And she was, it was a very different turn for her in this character. So I think that that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
All right. So jumping in, we open with some, you know, type on screen, America 2022. So do you know, put that in context? That was, you know, it was supposed to be 9 years in the future when this movie came out.
Right. Yeah.
Unemployment is at 1%. Crime is at an all-time low. Violence barely exists, with one exception. And then it goes black, and some new type comes up that says, "Blessed be the new founding fathers for letting us purge and cleanse our souls. Blessed be America, a nation reborn." So all of this is just like making your skin crawl.
Yeah, I'm like...
it's hard to like put yourself back in that mindset of 2013 before our country, you know, how all the things that have happened in our country since then.
January 6th.
But even just Trump's entire first term, January 6th and what we're looking ahead to now, like it's hard to imagine like, oh, we're just sitting there in 2013, like, yay, Obama. Uh-huh.
but I definitely got feeling of, kind of same way they are saying things, kind of like from a Handmaid's Tale, like when mm-hmm. they say blessed be the yes. different things like that, like
that dystopian
weird,
element.
Yeah, yeah. Weird sayings to each other. Like mm-hmm. this is how we, oh, we set out our flower, you know, like it's just mm-hmm. weird, culty.
Yeah. So it's
vibe.
Like, in order to really, like, I feel like see, get the most out of this movie, you really have to try and focus on the fact that, like, back then when they were presenting this dystopian scenario in 2013,
it was because a lot of things that have happened.
Yeah, looking at it now, you're like, yeah, no, that's reality.
Right.
That seems plausible.
I mean, it makes me think of Scream, for example, then I'll explain a little bit more why. That idea that teenagers could be, you know, killers or the brains behind mass killing mm-hmm. or like, you know, and very, very violent. And this was pre-Columbine, mm-hmm. right? And obviously smaller little things had happened. And like, I mean, killings had happened before in schools and there are shootings. Not to say that that didn't exist. That's not what I'm trying to say.
Columbine was definitely a threshold.
But that was the, Columbine was the one where it was on all media. Everyone was talking about it for years. And it was like a watershed mm-hmm. moment. Like, this is something that happens. And it was had reached everybody, mm-hmm. basically, as opposed to like maybe other killings or like teenager stuff like violence hadn't become like a well-known fact mm-hmm. that this is a possibility. So now I feel like this is kind of the same thing, like really kind of understanding that this is not completely out of the realm of possibility at this point in, you know, our society. How
especially like, well, you know, we can talk about the sequels later, but it continues mm-hmm. down that path in a way that's really unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now after that type on the screen, the opening credits appear over an assortment of security camera footage clips of citizens committing acts of violence against each other, played over serene instrumental music. The clips all carry stamps showing locations all over the United States and dates beginning in 2017 and then gradually working through 2022, which is when this film is supposed to be set. And many of the clips are identified in the screen stamps as quote unquote purge feed. So now James Sandin is driving. James Sandin is our Ethan Hawke main character. He's on speakerphone with a client, assuring him that his security system was repaired and will be safe tonight. James's next call is to his assistant, from whom he gets the news that he's number one. We're like, okay. Then he switches the radio to a broadcast, claiming that, quote, the poor can't afford to protect themselves. They are the victims tonight. James then drives through his opulent gated community, passing enormous homes, all decked out with American flags, all with blue flowers and outside, while the radio host continues to take calls, asking the callers their, quote, purge plans. Some are locking down behind their security system. Some are hunting down their bosses.
I'm going to give him what's coming to him.
give him what for. Then James stops to check in on a neighbor who's walking his dog, confirming that the friend ran a check on his security system like James had recommended. And then James arrives home to this just enormous house. Like, it's really gaudy. So then there's a date stamp, March 21st, 2022, 5:58 p.m., 62 minutes until the start of the annual purge. James goes inside, greets his lovely wife, Mary, who is Arlena Heady's character. The kids upstairs in their rooms, and Mary reports that their daughter Zoe is still pouting that dad won't let her date her 18-year-old boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Mary pauses to hear a psychologist on TV explaining that the purge allows us to release our base animal impulses and produces psychological stability for the country. Up in her room, Zoe is smooching said 18-year-old boyfriend, whose name is Henry, who leaves via her enormous balcony when they hear they can hear her dad come home. They do note a neighbor sharpening a machete next door, and Henry comments, someone's getting ready for tonight.
And I think also it said that certain weapons were allowed, right?
Are
you going to get into it? Okay.
Yeah.
Because you're like, machete, that's an odd choice.
But. Yeah, right. He's a ninja turtle. Out in front of the house, Mary's accosted by this syrupy sweet neighbor, Grace, who under the guise of delivering cookies is passive aggressively making snide comments that James selling a new security system to every home in the neighborhood is what paid for the new addition on the Sandin's house. So she's being a real twat about the whole thing.
She's like, we paid for that.
Yeah, like not everybody's having the year you guys are.
Like, well, listen, Karen.
Why don't you go?
It seems like you had a great year, considering where you live.
Yeah, right. You're doing fine.
We don't want to hear you, bitch.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, your cookies probably taste like garbage.
Yeah.
Anyway,
total shit. Back inside, we get a floor level view of footage from Son Charlie's creepy RC car that has a decimated baby doll mounted on top. So it's totally like straight out of Toy Story. Yes, 100%.
Toy Story. Oh, little scampy.
Yeah. So Mary Scampy scolds toys. Him for scaring her, like talking to the camera feed on the little RC apparatus. Charlie emerges from the secret cubby hiding space in his closet from where he was controlling Timmy. So Timmy's the name of the little baby doll RC thing. And then he goes into the kitchen and shows his moms the improvements that he's made to his creation. The family has dinner around the table, and James is trying to force family harmony, even though Zoe's being a snot, before announcing the news to everyone that, quote, he did it, and he's the top salesman at his security company this quarter. So he's like, yay!
They're like, way to go, Dad. I don't even care about you.
This is the worst. It's stupid.
I hate you. and he's like, well, anyway, I'm proud of myself.
but there's a bit of levity, like, between Zoe and Charlie. They're, like, kind of being cute and gross. And the parents are like, oh, my God, you guys stop. Before Charlie notices the time. It's almost 7 o'clock, which is time for lockdown. So the family gathers around numerous huge security feeds in this, like, one particular, like, security room. And James notes the behavior of their neighbors, but it's kind of unbothered by the whole thing. Like, oh, I didn't know those guys were friends. They're going hunting together, blah, blah, blah. So he removes a handgun from a safe that has lots of other, you know, extensive weapons in it. But, you know, he takes just the handgun, you know, just for precaution, and initiates the lockdown on their home security system. So these huge metal plates slowly lower over every window and door, like securing this giant house of theirs. They then listen at 7 o'clock to the emergency broadcast system announce the commencement of the purge. And this is where they give the details you mentioned. They say weapons of class 4 and below are authorized for use. So you're assuming like guns and knives, but you know, you can't like nuclear weapons or whatever.
Right, I'm assuming you can't get a tank. You can't do like Molotov something like that. Although, cocktails. No, maybe. But I think
that would be. Yeah. Cause that's just arson.
Sure.
Okay. I think it's just like higher, higher level, like military grade weaponry, like maybe like rocket launchers or, you know, something like that. Because obviously we see that, you know, shotguns, automatic weapons like AKs, those are acceptable. So whatever they define weapons of class 4 and below are authorized for use.
And people are.
Yeah. And government too. Officials of ranking 10 are immune and may not be harmed. So
if you have an founding fathers
are definitely, you know, thinking of themselves and their security.
They're like, if anyone has an axe to grind against us, you can't kill. Yeah, just you come can't and kill us.
We're safe. They're like, you know, we're on base. Remember that with like tag?
Yeah.
I'm on base.
I'm in safe. I'm the safe zone. Safe. And then I'm everyone's safe. Puppy guarding you and you're like, I gotta leave eventually.
Goddamn. So then the siren sounds, beginning the purge. And afterwards, Zoe snottily leaves the room. And then on his way out, Charlie stops and asks his parents why they don't, quote, do it. Like, why don't they participate in the purge? And after a pause, James tells him, because we don't feel the need to. That's all. James goes on to argue for the merit of the purge. That like all of the benefits of it. And he says that, yes, if he or Mary felt the need to, they would participate because it works.
Mary looks like horrified.
Yeah. Mary flashes him this look like, what the fuck are you saying? Ew. What now?
I'm disgusted by you.
Yeah. And James refers to, quote, how bad it was before the purge with poverty and crime and says that the purge saved the country. Charlie leaves unconvinced and still troubled.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know about
well, it's
this.
Like, you know, he's
he seems super curious.
Yeah, in terms of their age, like it seems like I would guess Zoe's 16, you know, 17 or so, if you know, because she's definitely like looks like later high school age. But if her dad has an issue with her dating an 18-year-old, then obviously she's not 18.
Not
so
of
I would
age.
Guess it's like she's just, but she definitely looks older than like 15. So she's like 16, 17 age. And so Charlie's probably like 13, 14 maybe. And it's definitely like at that age where you're starting to formulate your morality, your concept of ethics and everything. And he's growing up in this world where the purge is a reality. And so you could see him trying to reconcile this with, you know, the whatever concepts of right or wrong. He's obviously been instilled, you know, with by his parents, mm-hmm. That aren't the people that gladly jumped at the opportunity to go murder people.
Right.
And so he's trying to make sense of all of this, like in his early teen developmental phase that he's in. Mm-hmm.
Prefrontal cortex and all that.
Exactly. Good for him. Upstairs, Zoe's surprised to find Henry has snuck back in before the house locked down. So now he's inside and he couldn't get out if he wanted to. He couldn't sneak back out. Downstairs, there are overheard news reports that share a criminologist questioning if the purge is really about a release of violence or if it's about eliminating the weaker members of society. And maybe that's why the economy is flourishing, because of the eradicating of, quote, non-contributing members of society. So the poor, the sick, the homeless, the addicted, all of these folks that aren't, you know, working to make money for themselves and others, the purge, they're vulnerable during the purge, and so they end up being the victims, and the removal of them from society, perhaps this guy is suggesting, is the reason why the purge saved the economy.
Yeah. I mean, that seems very kind of
reasonable.
Yeah.
Sounds really airtight, actually. Mm-hmm. The clock is ticking. Mary works out on a treadmill. Charlie drives Timmy around the house. Zoe fools around with Henry in her bedroom until Henry reveals that he didn't come to do this. He came to talk to her dad and straighten things out. Like, he can't keep us apart. I'm just going to talk to him man to man and tell him how much I love you, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, little hard eyes. Mm-mm. So Charlie, using Timmy, Charlie spies on the security camera feeds in the security room, and he suddenly sees on those screens a man running up their street, seeming to be trying to escape from something. Meanwhile, Zoe in her room continues to protest, like he's not going to listen to you, you're not going to change anything, it's just going to make things worse, as Henry readies to go confront her dad. And so this is a moment where it jumps from room to room and character to character, because a lot of things end up happening right in the same moment, this like conflux of events that kind of kick everything else in motion. And so we've got this going on with Zoe and Henry. We have Charlie, like, first he sees with Timmy on the screen this guy running down their street. So then he goes himself down to the security room and, you know, turns on the audio. James and Mary are in the bedroom, and James is shopping for boats, you know, because he's going to get this big bonus. But Charlie gets the audio from the security feed, and he hears the man on the street screaming for help, like, somebody help me, And so right as Henry is striding out of Zoe's room to go confront James, and Zoe goes and sits down on her bed and puts her earbuds back in. Which, I'm like, what a fucking weird thing to do when your boyfriend's about to go confront your dad.
I'd be like, let me listen to this.
Yeah,
shit.
100%. I'm like, 100%.
I want to see what happens.
Yeah.
Also, remember how movies sometimes bother me and like weird things?
What bothers you about this?
When the mom goes to work out after drinking a bunch of wine and eating a full dinner.
Yeah, and then she's like, now it's time to hop on the treadmill.
And I'm like, really? That's what you probably... Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
It seemed like it must have been a pretty half-hearted workout, though, because, like, she didn't shower. She barely even changed clothes.
I'm going to do my 5 minutes.
Yeah, my little 5-minute jog.
Anyway, I was like, what?
Okay. That's how Lena keeps that tight ass that she's got.
Anyway, I was just, like, kind of laughing a little bit. Okay, yeah. Continue.
Okay, so Henry is heading to find James. James is shopping for boats. Charlie is listening to the man on the street, begging for
his help, life.
Somebody to let a place to hide. And so Charlie disengages the lockdown on the house. He runs to the front door and opens it and is calling the man inside, like, come on, get in. Of course, James immediately notices from the bedroom that the lockdown has been disengaged, and he runs to the security room and re-engages it, but the man manages to slip through the front door just in time. So now Charlie and the I call him the stranger for the course of the movie. Charlie and the stranger are just inside the front door. Zoe has emerged from her room because she hears this commotion. James arrives at the front door to see the stranger standing there with Charlie, and so James is like slowly draws hit the gun, you know, his,
like, who's this man?
Yeah, you know, like, what the fuck's going on? And right after James draws his gun, you know, with his attention on the stranger, Henry is walking down the stairs and pulls his own gun and fires on James. So now we realize Henry's plan was to take advantage of the purge opportunity to not talk to Zoe's dad, but to kill Zoe's dad, which, like, what a piece of shit.
What a jackass.
Yeah. So, but James already has drawn his gun because of the stranger that came in the front door. And so, you know, that Mary screams, he's got a gun. And so James turns and Henry and James both fire on each other. James is not hit, but Henry is. And Zoe, who she's just started down the stairs, grabs Henry and drags him back up to her bedroom. And in all of this commotion and distraction, the stranger has disappeared somewhere into the house. So that's like, that's obviously like a very dramatic moment with all of these elements, like, of what's going on, kind of coming together and being revealed all at once.
Yeah. And it's a massive house. There's, like, so many nooks and crannies and places to hide, too.
So while Zoe is crying over a dying Henry in her bedroom, James moves Charlie and Mary into the security room to, you know, because now there's this stranger in their house and they don't know where he is. And then James goes looking for Zoe. He's like, I got to go find her. He finds Henry lying dead in Zoe's room. She's not there. And we do see the shadow of the stranger behind him, and then the shadow is gone. So, you know, the stranger's moving around the house, but James isn't aware of where he is still. Mary downstairs in the security room hears Zoe calling. And so Mary leaves Charlie to go get Zoe. Zoe's like crying. She apologizes to Mary. She says, Henry's dead. She says, tell Dad, I'm sorry. Like, I didn't know he was going to do that. And then, but then Zoe ends up slipping away again as Mary, Charlie calls Mary back to the security screens. Because Charlie has seen that a group of people are approaching the house. So now Mary and Charlie are still in the security room. And then James, Zoe, and the stranger are all just, like, elsewhere in the in this enormous house. So James does return to the security room, and then they all look at the quote-unquote visitors outside, which are young men and women dressed in suits and white gowns.
Yeah, they look like they're just wearing their, basically, their clothes.
Their fancy clothes.
Like, you know, when they, private school clothes or, private high school clothes.
Yeah,
like
the boys,
their shirts.
The boys do, but I feel like the girls.
Jackets?
Yeah, the girls' dresses. Well, and you had said that there was a little tidbit about why the girls were dressed the way they were.
The writer of the movie also was, like, very, very, obsessed, I guess, or had a very big interest in the Manson family. So their dresses are, like, kind of 60s white,
flowy,
wispy,
white,
flowy
flower child type things.
Yeah, so that's what they're wearing.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, the boys are wearing, like, prep school like,
preparatory
blazers
school.
And ties. Yeah. So the Sandins listen to the leader, who is he's credited as, like, the polite freak, because when they credit this movie, they refer to all of these people that come to the house as freaks. I refer to them as the purgers in my recap, but this leader is, like, he's like the polite freak, right? And he's speaking to the Sandins through their security camera, and he says that their nice home and the blue flowers that they have outside show that they're one of the haves rather than the have-nots, and that they support the purge, because that's what the blue flowers are supposed to symbolize in America at this time, was that you support the purge. And so this leader, then he says that their neighbors informed the purgers that the Sandins have given sanctuary to the group's purge target. So obviously this stranger that they let into the house. He says that they have provisions on the way that will allow them to break into the Sandins' home. And if they don't give up the stranger before then they will become targets too. But he's basically like, you're one of us. I can see you're wealthy people, you're rich people, you support the purge and everything. So we don't have issue with you.
Yeah.
Turn over the homeless pig. Let us, you know, purge and cleanse ourselves. And it'll all be fine. But if you don't, then we'll just purge
you,
with
all of you
too.
Guys.
Yeah. He also, it's interesting, he quotes the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer in his statement, because he refers to them as, we are a bunch of, you know, highly educated young men and women. And he does speak, like, he speaks very articulately, very intelligently throughout the movie, like, that's clearly his character. But he's also, like, completely devoid of empathy, obviously.
Yeah.
But the Schopenhauer quote that he uses is, as wanting is our will. Because he's like, you know, we can get into your house if we want, and we will want, as wanting is our will. And so I actually like looked into it a little bit, and this concept that Schopenhauer was like trying to describe about how all human behavior is driven by our wants and how our wants become our will. Mm-hmm. And obviously I didn't, you know, research it super, super in depth, but just this, it's this philosophical, concept that's been around for a very long time, is very well known. And so the, usage of that by this purger just kind of reflects more about like his background, you know, the like prep school, college, like the education, and the kinds of things that he studied. Like these are the kind of people that are participating in this, like, let's hunt a human being down and kill it activity.
Definitely not somebody who basically seems to have avoided struggling his entire life, probably.
Yeah.
And doesn't understand the plight of anyone who's had to struggle for anything.
Exactly. So like the total lack of empathy. Uh-huh. So he concludes his speech, and suddenly the power to the house is cut. And at this point, James has to admit to Mary that the systems he sells are not, in fact, impenetrable.
She's like thinking it. He's like, eh.
Actually, they can.
I don't know.
but I love it because then he, James if uses the, what he actually says is, things like this aren't supposed to happen in our neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Because I'll sell you this like $1 million security system and tell you it'll keep you safe. But what really is keeping you safe is your affluence and the place where you live.
Yeah.
Because if somebody actually wanted to break into your home, this security system would not stop them.
Right. And it's also a deterrent. He said, like,
it looks good.
Yeah.
It looks, and she's like, it looks good. Like, what are you talking about?
What I thought.
Right. Yeah. You have misled me. And then we can also presume misled all of his clients.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of that, a lot of security systems are for that, like the signs, the things.
Yeah, a lot of people are like, they don't even have the security system. They just try to get a sign.
They're supposed to be a deterrent of some kind. Everything's kind of a suggestion of security, which is just kind of our reality as well. If you're just not exactly doing something that's original or something that doesn't actually exist in our actual society.
Yeah. Okay, so James declares that what they need to do is find the stranger and give him up. Charlie protests, obviously, because Charlie's the one that let him in and was trying to help him, and asks, why should he die? And James answers, it's him or us. James and Mary begin to search the dark house looking for the stranger, while the purgers outside leer at the cameras, bang on the barriers, and taunt them and just act like a bunch of fucking freaks. Which
they act like the stranger.
They do, 100%.
The weirdo, the weirdos and the strangers.
Yeah,
the home
and they're
invaders.
Also all, except for the polite leader, they all have those masks on.
Yeah.
Not animal masks like the strangers, but like doll masks. Well, I guess the strangers did have a doll mask.
Are you thinking about Your Next?
Oh, yes, I'm thinking of Your Next. The strangers were all doll masks.
They were like, one was human. Like a sack, like a potato sack, and then there's like weird human baby doll face or like the pinup girl mask.
Right.
Like definitely off-putting.
Yeah.
Creepy.
Yeah. And so all of these people, except for the polite leader, have their faces covered with these masks, which makes it way, way scarier.
I mean, it kind of felt akin to kind of wearing a hood. Like a clan hood or something.
Perhaps. You're hiding,
you know,
your identity.
Hiding who you are and to commit these egregious things.
To dissociate
even
from the
in
act.
In this world, it's permitted.
Yeah, and it's encouraged. It's considered, it's the narrative is that this is a good thing that you are doing. So you shouldn't have to be ashamed, and you don't need to hide your identity.
But they're doing
it anyway. And I think it's more, I imagine that it was more about, they knew that the masks would be intimidating and frightening.
The thrill of scaring people.
Yeah, as opposed to just their faces.
Yeah.
And I'm sure all of them were recovering from nose jobs and stuff like that, so.
They're like, we just got tan, spray tan.
Spray tan, we want to protect them. I just got a derma peel. Not supposed to be outside. Okay, so Charlie decides to use Timmy to search the house also, and he finds the stranger hiding in the living room and uses Timmy to signal to the stranger to follow this radio-controlled car. Mm-hmm. So Charlie uses Timmy to lead the stranger to the hiding place in Charlie's closet, and the stranger goes inside and is now hidden.
Yeah.
So Charlie's still trying to help. Charlie knows his parents are looking for the stranger, and he's helping him hide from Charlie's parents. So, the polite leader calls James to the front door, and they talk through this, like, little eye-level glass opening. James is explaining, he's like, why haven't you delivered the homeless pig yet? You know, James is explaining that this is all a misunderstanding. My son let him in. He's just a boy. He doesn't understand. We're trying to find the man.
I support
you.
Everything.
You know, this is a good thing. And so, you know, James is like being very placating and conciliatory to the polite leader. And but then this other perjurer who's standing kind of behind him gets tired of listening to James and just rushes up screaming at him through the door, like, give us it all, only to be casually shot in the head by his polite leader.
Mm-hmm. And my question is, how are these people, like, how are their ears just not ringing all
from
the
all the gunfire?
From like a he's like,
oh,
like,
yeah.
Right next to his ear hole. I'm like, yeah. How is he? And then he's like, I'm like, how are you hearing?
Maybe he already has tinnitus.
Maybe he's doing earplugs.
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. Sorry. Other weird thing I get hung up on.
Yep. Yeah, for real.
I'm becoming an old person.
Yeah. And this is a moment where it kind of, this reminded me a little bit of Hannibal Lecter about how he can't abide rudeness.
Yeah.
What the polite leader says. Like, he apologizes to James for his associate's behavior. He's like, you know, that was unseemly.
That was
distasteful.
Yeah.
So rude. But he's also like, he's my friend and I just shot him. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, the leader renews the threat that, you know, if you don't surrender our victim before everything else gets here, then we're coming in. And James assures him that they will find the stranger.
Yeah, and I think that moment made him realize for sure they mean to harm them. Yeah. They're not bluffing at all.
Okay, so Charlie's keeping watch over the stranger with Timmy. So he's still got Timmy in his bedroom, like kind of watching the, you know, the opening to the hiding place, until Zoe suddenly pops into view on Timmy's camera, telling Charlie that she has Henry's gun and that she is going to go hide in Charlie's secret spot. So Charlie's like, oh shit, no. Mm-hmm. And so next, James is still searching the house, brings him into Charlie's room. He's confronted with the stranger holding Henry's gun to Zoe's head. So obviously Zoe went into Charlie's spot to hide, and the stranger has taken her hostage now with the gun that she had.
Mm-hmm.
So as James is negotiating with the stranger, he notices Mary approaching unheard behind the stranger, and Mary's also still armed. But then the cocking of Mary's gun alerts the stranger, and this whole group struggle follows. It's like kind of hard to track what's happening because, you know, the house is still dark with no power. But in the end, Zoe's unconscious from, you know, getting her head knocked into the wall, and the stranger has been shot and is also unconscious. So James leaves to find rope to tie up the stranger and deliver him to the perjurers. And we can see in Charlie's face just this disgust and like disappointment that his dad is still doing this, that his dad's going to turn the stranger over to the perjurers.
Yeah, just to be
like
executed.
Disillusionment to like who his father is.
Yeah.
so they duct tape the stranger, like his hands and legs and everything, but then he regains consciousness and is fighting to get away. So James directs Mary to go grab a letter opener and shove it into the stranger's gunshot wound. And Charlie's just like screaming and begging her to stop. And Mary obviously is doing all of this reluctantly, but mm-hmm. James is like, you have to help this. You have to do this. You have to do this.
Kids. Yeah. They're going to kill us.
Exactly. So she's crying and screaming, and Charlie's screaming at her, just like, Mom, stop. So it's just like a very obviously tense, intense moment. And so they get the stranger stops struggling so that Mary will stop stabbing his gunshot wound with a letter opener. And as they're taping him to a chair, Mary also starts to question what they're doing to the man and question James himself. Mm-hmm. Like, who, you know, what are we doing? Like, how can we do this? Like, you know, and then Charlie can't take it anymore and he leaves. So Mary goes after Charlie, and in that moment, James realizes that Zoe has regained consciousness as well. So he goes to her, and he apologizes to her for killing Henry, but he says everything's going to be okay. But then she's just talking like a zombie, and she also calls him on his shit, and she says, look what you're doing. Nothing mm-hmm. is ever going to be okay again.
Yeah, like, who are you after you commit something like this?
Yeah, yeah.
Even if it's, like, accepted by people in this world,
this is,
I guess.
This, like, you know, we've been talking about there's the before and after. Like, there are some moments where, like, everything that comes after is changed fundamentally because mm-hmm. of this thing that's happened. And at this point, so obviously the stranger has been listening to all of this and watching this family dynamic, and he himself tells James to save his family and take him outside. He's like, fine, just... You know, he's looking at Mary and Charlie and Zoe, and like maybe wouldn't give a shit if James died. But he's looking at this family, and he doesn't want to be the reason that these children and their mother are killed. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, fine, just put me outside, protect your family, which is very noble.
Right. And he's wearing also dog tags, too. Yeah. So you would assume he's had military experience. You'd think that I mean, I kind of took that moment to kind of look at him more because it was in the dark. He was running. He was, always like, this is the first moment where he's like, the camera's on him for like a good little bit of time. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking he's unhoused. He's, you know, maybe has PTSD. Other reasons. There's like reasons that he, you know, has probably led to him being, mm-hmm. you know, where he is.
Yeah.
And it's not entirely as these other people who are attacking him or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not his fault.
Right.
You know, it's like take some ownership and where he is in
right.
his life.
Yeah, because he doesn't, everything that he does gives no indication that he is a violent person, that he's a threat to anybody. He only ever acts in self-defense.
Yeah.
He's completely lucid and, you know, like obviously behaving in a manner where he's fighting for his life. But, you know, he doesn't appear to be like on anything or have any like organic mental disorders or anything, because we know that those are all kinds of things that sometimes lead to a person being unhoused. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be anything that he's dealing with. And so
So these people just want him because he had the audacity to fight back.
Right.
And he killed one of them. Mm-hmm. So they have an axe to grind and they're like, execution time. We need to get this guy. And
exactly.
Anyway.
Which is all fucked up. Mm-hmm. Okay, so time is now up. This big ass truck has arrived outside with chains to pull down the security doors, like the big metal plates covering the doors and windows. But James has a new plan. So he has been swayed by his family's pleas and also by this stranger's, like, you know, offer of self-sacrifice. And James gives Charlie a gun and sends him to go hide in the basement. And then he informs Mary that they're going to fight back. They're going to defend their family and they're going to fight back against these perjurers that are now going to, you know, come into the house. So a final, you know, soliloquy from the leader of the perjurers, the polite leader, and they yank the security door down. James and Mary...
pretty seamlessly. They're like...
Yeah, like it took no effort at all. It kind of seemed like they could have done it with a crowbar.
They're like, that took about 5 seconds. All right, we're here.
And then they just smash the windows and just step right in.
Yeah, they're like, cling, 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 we're in.
Yeah, I'm like, how much did people actually pay you for this?
Jeez, that's embarrassing for everybody involved.
So, James and Mary are lying in wait in the dark house as the windows are broken, and we see that they left the stranger taped up to the chair, which is kind of bullshit. Like, obviously, they didn't have time.
Too, right?
They, you know, it's not like they were like, oh, we've got 5 minutes to kill. Let's go cut his tape or whatever. But now they're like, no, we're going to decide to protect ourselves because we know these people are coming in, and we're just going to leave you completely helpless, duct taped up to a chair.
Yeah, that seems...
Yeah.
Short-sighted.
Yeah, they weren't, it wasn't a flawless plan.
I know. Well, the camera went back to him and I was like, oh, that guy's still there?
God damn it.
In the chair?
Okay. Yeah, but he, you know, he is clearly a survivor and he's working to free himself. Like he, you know, knocks his chair over, grabs something sharp. He's, I don't remember if it was a letter opener or whatever, mm-hmm.
It was the letter opener that she used to stab him in his guts.
As the purgers start entering the home very mm-hmm. easily through, you know, wide open windows. And I put, Charlie the dummy isn't smart enough to turn off his flashlight while he hides in the basement.
Oh my God.
So he's found by one of the purgers. He's like hiding and shining a flashlight like all over the fucking place, like to see what's going on or to see if anyone's coming. I'm like, dude. Oh,
there you are. You're right over here. I see you.
So then you can see like he's smart. He's empathetic, but he's also like, you know, naive. This is a kid that's never had to worry about his own safety or you look out for himself in any way from his background.
Yeah.
So he does something really fucking stupid.
And he's like, I don't hear anything. I'm going to go out and look. I'm like, oh my God.
Oh my God. And so the purger, you know, is just about to kill Charlie, but, you know, James arrives behind him and shoots the purger. And so this is where I realized through the rest of this, and I always think of this now, that because the first time it ever happened was with Paranormal Activity, when you were like, Katie cries, Mika comforts her. Like, the whole rest of the movie is like, he was about to kill him, and then someone else kills him. But just before he could kill him, this person kills him. So there's like half a dozen moments throughout the rest of the movie where someone is just about to be killed and then someone else pops in and kills the killer.
There's a little, I was thinking about that too, actually, in this movie. Not because of that. It was like, oh, one of the kids ran away. Oh, and another that one of the kids ran away. Yep. Oh, the other kid ran away.
Now Charlie's gone. Now Zoe's gone. Now Charlie's gone.
In the dark house. Oh, they.
Nobody knows where this kid is.
I know. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's a little cyclical, maybe. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so now
Mika comforts her.
Katie cries. Mika comforts her. So James stashes Charlie back in the security room, and we see that Zoe's actually hiding under a bed upstairs. So now we know where they are.
Come find me. I'm under the bed.
Peek-a-boo. So James has, you know, tapped into what some of the more impressive arsenal from his safe that, you know, he didn't take out initially. And he, you know, he kind of goes Ethan Hawke bad at, like, it's a little like, is this John Wick that we're seeing now? Like, who is this, like, this mild-mannered security salesman? Because he, first he takes out one guy in the kitchen with just, like, fucking monster gun thing that he has. I can't even tell what it is because he holds it.
It's kind of like a weird Uzi thing.
Yeah, because he holds it like a chainsaw. Like, he holds it from, like, a handle above. It's not something where you, like, position it, like, normally like a shotgun where, like, there's a butt against your shoulder. Like, he's like a leaf blower or something is the way that he's handling it, but it's a firearm.
Yeah.
Really bizarre.
And it has, like, shotgun shells.
Yeah,
like
yeah, because you can hear the shells hitting the floor after every time he fires a round.
Like, there's, like, the hollow tap of the plastic hitting the ground.
So he gets one guy in the kitchen with that. Then he heads into the billiard room. He comes across a couple that's in there, a man and a woman, and fights with them. And then after he takes both of them out.
That couple made me laugh because they're walking down the hall pointing pictures.
And she's piggyback.
Like, they're basically like, tee-hee, tee-hee.
Yeah. We're so silly.
We're just some silly geese. just running amok.
Honk, honk.
I know. Sorry. That just kind of took me out of the moment for a second.
Yeah,
when I was watching.
That is the like the that was very Manson Strangers element as well. Like the girls would be like skipping down the hall, or you know they're like that. We enjoy this. This is fun because we're sociopaths.
Yeah, we're here to play.
But then so he kills that couple. Then a third perjurer comes in. He kills him too. And I put he's very inventive in this scene with like the fighting that goes on. At one point he brains one of the guys with a billiard ball.
Yeah.
Then he smashes one guy's head repeatedly into a pinball machine until he's like dead or whatever. And then finally, the third guy he kills using the axe that the female perjurer had had.
Yeah.
And so it's like this really like, you know, not lengthy. It wasn't super drawn out fight scene, but it's just basically like, who is this guy? Like, this is like Jason Statham. Like,
the will to survive is strong, I guess.
Right? He's just going to totally take out these people. And maybe it's a commentary. And like when you have something to protect, when you're protecting your family and your home, you fight in a different way than if you're just a sociopath who's just out to do this for a lark. You know, like he's not just doing it for the fun of it. He's doing it to in defense of his family and himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe that's what they, you know, what that was supposed to kind of point to.
On the other hand, his wife is pretty useless.
Yeah. So she's fucking. Yeah. So she's been walking around this whole time. And there's been a bunch of moments where
like
a perjurer has like silently
like,
appeared behind her and followed her.
She didn't
but nobody's
say hello.
Attacked her
she
yet.
She wasn't like shouting out.
No.
But
she was
seems
just
like she might as well have been
walking around with her pistol pointed, accomplishing absolutely nothing. But we're still with James in the billiard room and all is quiet after he's killed these three perjurers. But then, you know, he steps into a hall and is met with the polite leader who stabs him with like this just giant blade.
A huge like knife.
Yeah,
I don't
like
know
not
what
full on machete size, but like a monster knife.
Yeah.
And
it
then
it seems like it'd be something for like a you take to the swamp.
I'm gonna get and kill
go,
some gators.
Go find some gators or something.
So he, you know, he lays this stabbed James on the floor. This polite leader tells him that his soul is cleansed because he is purged. Not the leader's soul, but he was like telling James, your soul is cleansed because you have purged. But then he asks if the stranger's life was really worth James's family's life. So he's like questioning his choice. Like he's kind of applauding James fighting back and killing, but then questioning James's choice to align with the homeless pig rather than who he should have, which would be his rich peers
basically
who were
his
purging.
Own.
Yeah, exactly. Then the leader thanks James, kisses his forehead like a real weirdo, and then leaves James on the floor to die.
Thank you for your service.
Exactly. Okay, so we're almost wrapping this up here. In the security room, Charlie is watching on the TV. There's some purgers still outside, but then he sees a few of his own neighbors walk up and shoot the purgers. Mm-hmm. And so you're almost like, oh, rescue, right? So meanwhile, Mary finally encounters a pair of purgers and is immediately disarmed, quickly overpowered.
And she's like, ee!
And pinned to the floor.
She's like, oh no!
Yeah, so she should be, she should give up the treadmill and start doing some like taekwondo or something.
Yeah.
Because she's useless. So they have her pinned to the floor, but before they can kill her, more neighbors arrive and shoot the purgers. So more mm-hmm. neighbors have come into the house, shoot the purgers, and save Mary. But then they just kind of like drift away. So meanwhile, so Mary, you know, gets up and walks into the entryway. She finds James struggling in the foyer, like he's gotten to the bottom of the stairs, and Charlie joins them there. So the three of them are like huddled together at the bottom of the stairs with this, you know, fatally wounded James. And then the polite leader arrives, compliments James on, you know, this whole, you know, symphony that they've executed together. The polite leader blesses America and prepares to shoot them, but Zoe shoots him first. Mm-hmm. So it's another moment where, like, you're just about to die, but then they die first. So Zoe, you know, somewhere along the line has ended up with somebody's gun, probably Henry's gun from, I don't know when. She ended up with a handgun. And mm-hmm. so she shoots the polite leader.
Yeah.
And then she goes, you know, and joins her family, and they all huddle together at the bottom of the stairs as James slowly slips away. And then Grace, our neighbor Grace, walks in into the foyer with another man. Mary thanks them, and Grace explains that they decided to help because, quote, you're ours, not theirs. And then Mary's like, oh, farts. Mm-hmm. So then the neighbors take them all up.
I always knew you were an asshole.
She's like, you bitch.
And your cookies taste like shit.
Yeah. And who puts raisins in chocolate chip?
Monsters.
Monsters. So the neighbors tape up Mary and the kids as Grace explains that when the neighbors saw the Sandin's barrier down, they saw an opportunity to cleanse themselves of their hatred for feeling taken advantage of by James's sales. Mary begs for the kids' lives, and Grace just looks at her just fully psychotic, like her facial expression, like no mask needed. This woman, this actress executes this face and demeanor and temperament with the lines that she's delivering. She's like using phrases like cleanse. She's like, we'll be better people after this. You've sacrificed yourselves. We're doing our duty as Americans. And you're like, Jesus Christ, lady. Like, oh my God, it is so frightening.
And she's doing this with like kind of like a smile. Like,
yeah, but like also like kind of vacant eyes. And it's almost like a half smile. Like, oh my God, her face in that scene is so horrifying. Mm-hmm. So the Mary and the children are all taped up. The neighbors stand around them in a circle and chant the Blessed Be prayer, like you were referencing from the Handmaid's Tale bit.
Blessed
like,
be the fruit. Blessed be the murder we're about to commit.
Yeah, like it was Blessed Be America, a nation reborn. Right as they're about to start stabbing their victims, all of a sudden Timmy cruises by with his music playing, and clearly having used that as a distraction, the stranger knocks out one neighbor and then takes Grace hostage. Mm-hmm. So now he's come to the rescue of the family, and he's got a gun to Grace's head. So the other neighbors, because Grace is being threatened, they untie the Sandins, and once free, the stranger, he's still got the gun on all the neighbors who don't have guns. They were planning on stabbing the Sandins, so they didn't have any guns in their hands, even though they clearly had them when they arrived. Mm-hmm. So
they wanted it to last, actually.
Yeah, they
right?
wanted to
they
savor
wanted to,
it.
Like, stab them.
Yeah, because Grace was like, I'll go first and then we'll take turns. Like, mm-hmm. they were just going to stab them over and over again until they were dead.
Like the strangers did.
Yeah. And so, but now the stranger, our stranger, our good guy stranger, has the gun on the neighbors, and he says to Mary, your call. Like, mm-hmm. you tell me, are we killing them? And Grace urges, like, just get it over with. Just do it. Just do it quickly. Get it over with. But Mary refuses because she's not a fucking murderer. And she was like, no more killing tonight. No one else is going to die tonight. And so they all end up sitting in this silent standoff, like in the dining room or the, you know, parlor or whatever, waiting for 7 a.m. to roll around. Mary's momentarily distracted at one point, looking at the kids who are crying over James's dead body. And Grace jumps at the opportunity to try and grab a shotgun, and Mary just knocks her shit out, just slams the butt of the shotgun into Grace's face, and then grabs her by the hair and smashes her face into the table and just like breaks the glass on the surface of the table. Mm-hmm. And like, and Grace's face just explodes in blood and everything, and Mary just screams at her, "I said no more killing tonight." And you're like, wow, Mary has summoned something she did not before.
Where was that fight earlier?
Exactly. Oh, so then the sirens sound, indicating the end of the purge, the 12 hours, and Mary sends the neighbors away. And then as the stranger walks out too, Mary thanks him, and he wishes her good luck. The final shot shows the three surviving family members standing in their giant doorway looking at the sun-washed carnage in the front yard, all the dead bodies, the truck, like everything. And sirens start to wail to start the recovery. Because I think I forgot to mention earlier that, like, emergency services are suspended during the purge. Like, police, fire, medical, like, everything. Like, nobody is responding to anything during the purge. And so as soon as the purge is over, then you hear police and fire and everybody to start going out to start the cleanup or whatever.
Yeah.
And the audio of a newscast begins remarking on, like, a vigil is gathered in Times Square honoring the memory of those who sacrificed their lives, talking about the economy, that the founding fathers have already released a statement, this is the most successful purge yet. But then also we hear one man stating that he lost his two sons in the night and once was a proud American, but not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's the purge.
Good synopsis.
Ooh, what did you think, Meredith? Is this scary?
No, I mean, it's definitely suspenseful in parts, but I didn't feel like it was scary. I felt like it was more commentary on, like,
what it suggests is terrifying.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I enjoyed the movie. I know that it was pretty low budget. The actors kind of were all paid scale. Mm-hmm. And Ethan Hawke is a friend of people who made the movie, so he kind of just did it. Basically, just to put a big name behind the movie,
yeah,
you know. So then he, in exchange for the promise that if it's profitable, he would get money, or everyone who participated would get money,
yeah,
you know, for part of the box office.
But and, if not, yeah, he was going to be fine.
Bummer for you. But it ended up being probably one of the most profitable movies he'd ever done for him. Like
at that point,
like,
yeah.
Well, I mean, overall in his career,
like even to date,
I want to say he's gotten so much money because it was so like. So successful,
yeah.
From what I read, but I didn't go too far into depth. But I love the concept. I think it's crazy. Also, like my background, you know, criminology, criminal justice. It's a very intriguing idea.
Yeah,
you know, what if there was a concept where there was a night where everyone could do what they wanted for 12 hours? Like, how would that impact society? And it seemed very like social sciences.
100%. Yeah,
like kind of wondering. But scary, no, but I think definitely thoughtful, interesting. Mm-hmm. I always think that this concept is pretty wild. But subsequent movies I have not really had an interest in because I get kind of bored by the same same storyline over and over again. But I think I might watch them because I read more about them. Have you watched them?
So, yeah, I watched two of the sequels just this last week.
Does it do more... of an explanation on the why and the background and like, because to me it seemed like there was a lot of left unsaid and, you know, an assumption that it's good and the assumption that everyone's participating when clearly that's not the case and it's the haves versus the have nots. Mm-hmm. And like if everyone who's like the wealthy people who want to go participate in this just went down to Skid Row and killed everybody.
Right.
How many resources would be freed up?
Yeah.
That's reality. Yeah. Right.
And that was the intention. That's where the story ends up going. Yeah.
Right. That's what it was, you know, meant for.
Yeah.
Basically. But it was presented as something else.
Yeah.
It'll help you psychologically.
Yes.
But that's not the reality.
Well, and also marrying it with elements of faith, elements of, you know, Christian dogma. Like cleansing your soul and, you know, the blessed be, like giving it that.
Yeah.
That element of toxic American Christianity.
White nationalist.
Yeah.
You know, threads.
Yeah.
Very, very strong. It's very present. So I kind of thought about that a little bit. And then the and then for anybody of our listeners who maybe want to think, why bring politics into, you're talking about horror movies. And yeah. I get that. I read that kind of comment sometimes. And when people are talking about movies or books or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think it's, and I've said this through the years. Now we're on our fifth year, that the horror genre, sometimes it's just fun.
Yeah.
You know,
sometimes it's just Leprechaun.
Sometimes it's just Leprechaun. But a lot of times there's intent by the creator and the writers and the directors and the people who are making these films that they are representative of something else in our society. Mm-hmm. It represents like people being oppressed, or it has something to say. The monsters are an allegory.
Right.
It's all supposed to be secret. It's like even Mary Shelley, the allegory,
right.
Like yeah. The idea that you keep these two things separate. Politics is, you know, don't go into that. How?
Yeah.
Because that's the intent. Mm-hmm. And that completely misses the point.
Right.
So I think it's, and that also goes hand in hand with critically thinking and understanding what things represent.
Yeah.
This is very overwhelmingly political.
Right.
And to say it's not is, you know,
well, and then to farcical. Like be like, I want to ignore that element of it. And it's like, oh, so then you just want to like it for the brutal killing.
Right. So, okay.
Which, you know, Texas Chainsaw, I'm there for it.
Sure. But even but, that was meant, I mean, there's all, everything yeah, represents
that's
something.
That's true. That's true.
From these creators and the minds that create these mm. scenarios
at least the ones
and
that
situations.
Become, the ones of significance.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to preface it with that. And, yeah. And
like, why'd you get so political?
Well,
I always hear Georgia Hardstark's voice in my yes. I liked them until they got political.
I liked them until they got political. Well, this is all the movies, most maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm not going to say all, but most have something more to say about society.
Yeah.
And
and that's what art, you know, is.
Yeah. You know, art and music and the idea, like saying artists or musicians should stay out of politics. Well, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
Hello. Where maybe you weren't listening to
the lyrics. People have something to say and they find different ways to say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that I did want to mention that I thought it was interesting because there was a change in the movie, but the writer intended first.
Okay.
The intention was to have the daughter try to kill the dad.
Oh, instead of Henry.
Instead of Henry, but the studio, they wanted the boyfriend to yeah. do it. I think I kind of preferred the boyfriend, honestly. I
yeah.
think it would have been a little bit odd
yeah.
or strange to have the daughter have an
it
extra guy.
It would have muddied the waters.
It would have changed the whole, like, I'm protecting my family.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. So I thought that
yeah,
was
no,
kind of interesting.
Yeah, no, I definitely liked, I think I like it this way better
yeah.
Than what I imagine it, how it would have landed if it had been Zoe.
Right, yeah. So yeah. that change was interesting. Right.
Yeah.
But the costumes of the guys who are coming to kill them made me think of the Preppy murder. And we mm-hmm. talked before the podcast about, like, Patrick Bateman and how mm-hmm. he was killing unhoused and, like, people who were, like, working on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of with no one cared.
Right.
Or at least in his mind. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I, you know, in the book and movie. And then yeah, I don't know. I think this movie, it gives you a lot to think about. I think it's fun to yeah. think about that, but also a little scary considering, like, where we are right
where
now,
are
what's
now.
Going on.
Yeah.
White nationalism is being taught in schools. I yeah. mean, it's like taking a hold.
Out in the open,
hold.
Nobody feels like they need to hide it anymore.
Yeah, it's taking a hold in so many aspects of our American life, mm-hmm. which is so frightening. So I think this movie is terrifying in a completely different reason
yeah.
or other way.
Yeah.
But did you find it scary?
So no, like you say, watching the movie in terms of like a scary movie, it's not frightening in that sense. Like it's thrilling, it's interesting. It, you know, it's enjoyable. And but the reason I've always loved it, in addition to Ethan Hawke, because I love him,
me too.
is
I love him
the
too.
The concept. Like this, let's present like theoretically, if the United States did this, what would happen? And like you, I had never had any interest in any of the sequels. I didn't even know how many there were. And I felt that way because I assumed that, it was just, like you always say, like a cash grab to mm-hmm. like use the success of this first movie to just make gory, violent movies.
Yeah.
And that it would just be repetitive and it would lose the essence of what the value that I saw in this one, which was this suggestion of, you know, what if in our society?
Yeah. A social commentary.
Yeah. So, but when we picked it, this to The Purge to do for this episode, I was like, all right, well, let me go see. And I looked out. So there are four sequels. One came out the very next year in 2014. It was called The Purge Anarchy. Mm-hmm. Then there was one called The Purge Election Year that came out in 2016. Mm-hmm. Then there was the first Purge, which came out in 2018. And then the Forever Purge just came out in 2021. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I just looked on the streaming services and two of them were available for free. And so I was like, okay, I'll watch these because they're free. The other two were for rent. So I did not watch the second one, Anarchy, mm-hmm. and I didn't watch the fourth one, which was the first Purge. So I assume first Purge indicates it's a prequel, but who knows?
I read a little bit about it. It's where it came from, kind of the idea and the seeing it like in motion, like mm-hmm. what happened because like a doctor, social sciences doctor was like, I think this is my thesis. This is what I think will happen. It will mm-hmm. reduce violence or whatever. So let's like see how it plays out in this one like small area and what happened after that.
So that sounds like and so what I'll say is the first one that I watched was Election Year and I was very pleasantly surprised. Because what I realized is that at least the two sequels I watched were extremely different from mm-hmm. the original, only in that it's like a small scale versus large scale story. Like the first one was like a character study of like, okay, if American society became this, how would different individuals act? How would one family unit react? How would this play out in one incident with one attacker and one victim, or one group of attackers and one group of victims, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other two movies that I watched were all more societal wide. Like how would if this, you know, existed in American society, what would it look like on the large scale? And so the election year, and it's funny because so it came out in 2016. So when they were making it and, you know, doing the final edits and everything, obviously, like they knew who was running for president and who would be participating in the United States election. But when you watch the movie, it kind of seems like they didn't think there was any chance Trump would win. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the premise of election year is that now it's, you know, however many years down the road and there is a presidential election occurring between the incumbents who are the, you know, the founding fathers, that political party who are the ones that started the purge. But it recognizes that there are all sorts of groups in society that are protesting the purge that recognize that it's just an economic tool and that, you know, that it unfairly targets, you know, the poor, that they're victimized and everything. And it's just a tool for keeping power and making money and exterminating these unwanted populations by this toxic political party that's in power. And then you have the senator who's running against the incumbent who was when she was younger, like a teenager or whatever, her entire family was killed in a purge, mm-hmm. in front of her. Mm-hmm. And so she spent her entire political career fighting back against it, trying to stop it. And now she's running for president to try and end the purge. And so, then obviously they're going into the last purge that's going to occur before this presidential election and everything that happens during that purge. Mm-hmm. And it has some really like really great characters that it came up with. Not like super deep and complex, but just enough to give you that like spectrum of all the different people that are stuck dealing with this reality and the different ways that they respond. Mm-hmm. So you have like the participants, obviously, but then all of this portion of America that don't participate and have to protect themselves, or that the ones that are fighting back or trying to help others survive mm-hmm. this experience. And so you get a much broader picture. And then the other sequel that I watched was the most recent one that came out in 2021. And this one, I think, was probably the scariest in terms of hitting home in reality, because it's called The Forever Purge. Mm-hmm. And it's basically like all of the people that had been emboldened by decades of participating in an annual purge have decided that the purge just doesn't end after 12 hours. Mm-hmm. We just get to keep purging and kill. And it's very racially motivated. Like, it's set in Texas. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of elements of like anti-immigration, anti-Mexican, like friction and just people. But it's also like this story and like all of the characters and events take place in Texas, but the concept is that across the country there has been this movement fueled by social media about creating this forever purge, that when the purge is over, we're just not going to stop. Mm-hmm. and we're going to keep killing other races, killing poor people, you know, like the government tries to step in, but they can't because they're over. It's like this monster they've created, mm-hmm. and now they can't control it. It was just like
putting it back in the box. It's like it's impossible.
Yeah, but. So it didn't just get the ugliness out of us and make us able to go right back. Like that idea that you could one night go out and murder someone in cold blood and then the next day go back to your job at Starbucks mm-hmm. and be okay. Mm-hmm. It's like, no. And then especially if that's your society's ethos for long enough, this is what it produces mm-hmm. is, you know, people who have lost all concept of the value of human life or right or wrong because this behavior has been encouraged. And now the people that created this thing to try and stay in power and make money now are themselves in danger because everybody else that has been given this free rein to just, you know, hate and attack and be violent and kill and have had it validated for so long that it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You can't control it anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's like very upsetting.
Sure.
Because that is where we are. That's where we are right now.
Yeah. But even in the past as well, obviously, like mass lynchings, other things, mm-hmm. you know, completely sanctioned.
Yeah.
Essentially with law enforcement in some way incapacity taking or participating, like mm-hmm. I'm talking about, like in the Deep South during Jim Crow, other things.
Yeah. Where but then ultimately the federal government stepped in and
mm-hmm. But it took a long time. Yes. Like, you know, decades of basically egregious crimes.
But this is suggesting what if the federal government was that podunk Southern sheriff that was being like, yeah, go ahead and do that, good old boys. It's like now the federal government is saying, yeah, go ahead and do that, good old boys, to the entire country.
Well, yeah, here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
Here we are, Pete. Women are property.
It's
pretty interesting.
I loved the first one, and I totally will eat crow about my assumptions about the sequels. Now, like I said, I can't speak for the Anarchy or for the first Purge, but I really actually, I was happy to see that it wasn't just a more killing, more killing, more killing.
Yeah,
like actually, they continue like to try to explore the story and explore this premise of what would happen, what would this look like, mm-hmm. how would different people respond, how would our society respond, and how would our government respond?
Yeah, yeah, I do have a few interesting tidbits about like how this was even come up with, like mm-hmm. this whole concept.
Let's hear.
First the director writer had a road rage incident, and he was almost hit And then he was like, got out of the car, both cars stopped, and they were kind of wrestling each other to the ground until it was like they were like pulled apart, but he was like pissed.
Yeah.
And his wife, as a joke, was like, wouldn't it be fun if we just like had one day where we just go like pop off one person, you know, and he's like, haha, that's funny. But also
he rushed off to his computer.
But he's like, let me premise this by saying my wife is like a really kind, awesome person. So that was like a joke, but it got him thinking basically. Yeah. And then, Hurricane Katrina was another part of, that kind of solidified the idea of the purge idea, because the lack of government services such as police and ambulances and insufficient government response in New Orleans helped.
You mean like the lack of help that LA is getting?
Yeah, but at the time, right during Katrina, basically everyone's like, bummer for you.
That was 2004. Oh,
it was way before. Before this.
Yeah.
So it was very, very documented what had happened in the 8th Ward and all that stuff. Or is it the 9th Ward? I don't know. I was confused. But it was an area that was deeply impacted.
Was it Fred Ward?
Fred Ward. and no one helped. Right.
Yeah.
And then I already said about the homicidal white dresses or homicidal ladies came from Charles Manson. And then the polite leader was cast just like the day before filming started because of his sly confidence and his kind of creepy smile.
Yeah, he had great. Like it was almost like he would have made a good Joker.
Yeah, he was great. And then the movie cost $3 million to make, and it made about $89 million when it was released. And there's also, it was turned into a scare zone at Hollywood Universal, and I went to go do that, and I thought it'd be boring, and I was like, I don't really care about this, but then it was awesome.
Yeah,
it was so cool because it took you had to go on a tram, and it took you over to the lot where they did a lot of filming, and there's like a crashed plane.
Yeah, which I think that's from the second one, from Anarchy.
There's a crashed plane. There's even the psycho house.
Yeah.
Like also, and then they had just people around. There was like smoke, people with bats, chainsaws, masks. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. It was fun. But we kind of walked through, we're like, running through it. Anyway, I mean, I could talk on and on. I think this is a really interesting concept. I think it's, the movie is good. So I want to watch the next ones, I think, to just kind of see how it ends. But I think they're doing another one, I want to say.
Yeah.
Another one's coming out.
I mean, well, yeah, because now they're kind of just documenting reality. So they got to keep going.
Yeah.
Because like I was saying, the indication in election year that made me think like, oh, they didn't think Trump was going to win was because at the end, over the end credits, because the film concludes with the presidential election after the purge that is the bulk of the movie. And this is a spoiler podcast. So the woman ends up winning the presidency.
That's silly. That would never happen.
Yeah. But so she, you know, she is going to take office. She's going to end the purge and everything. And so there's audio of like newscasts saying that once the, you know, she reached the 270 electoral votes and she was declared having won the election, that protests and acts of violence, like organized acts of violence, were breaking out around the country against her election. And so it was like funny because it kind of seems like, oh, they were predicting like in this election that Clinton was going to win and Trump wasn't. But what they were describing sounded just like January 6th. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, oh my God, they predicted so much.
How did they know? Just look at the history books and you'll know in like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is depressing. Anyway. Yeah.
Wah, wah. But tomorrow, let's all watch PBS.
Ugh, yuck. I'm disgusted.
At least we don't have to be at school. We don't have to, talk to people or talk to children while that's going on.
I know. Everyone's going to be like, a new president. And I'm like, I'm disgusted. I would never say that. I have to think it in my head because I have to be, you know, diplomatic about it all.
Yeah.
Good talk.
Yeah.
We are going to do our next movie. It was my idea.
And we haven't seen it yet. Neither of us have seen it yet.
No, it was not my idea. I'm joking because it was Andy who was a guest on here for like once or twice before. He suggested we do it because a lot of buzz is happening around that movie. And we're talking about The Substance. The Substance. That came out in 2024 this past year.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, it's still in theaters.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So it has Demi Moore and I can't remember the other.
Margot Qualley?
Yeah.
You said? Yeah. Andy McDowell's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I heard it's weird and crazy and very good, and I have no idea what to expect, but we're going to talk about that next time.
Awesome.
I'm just going to ignore everything that's happening in the world.
Yep.
Dive
into horror.
I mean, I'll vote accordingly, but I can't. Like, my brain hurts.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I get too riled up.
you do need to be able to not fully dissociate.
No, but not fully dissociate. Compartmentalize. That's, yeah. I'm very good at that.
Yeah.
So I have to get back into that mode, which I did already for 4 years before.
Yeah.
Just kind of hope.
And as long as we can make it through this 4 years without him managing to change the Constitution so that he can run again, then hopefully this is the last 4 years.
I know. I keep telling Victor, I'm like, another ghoul is going to take his place. And it's the same hot garbage.
We'll see.
We'll see.
Or things will get so bad in the next 4 years that maybe people will wake up.
No, no, no.
No?
Don't be silly.
I'm not being silly. I'm trying to be hopeful.
Nah. Don't be hopeful.
God damn it. All right.
Oh, and
hope is gone.
Yeah. Also thinking about everyone down south in LA area. Victor's aunt lost her house. It burned down.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
So she's okay.
Yeah.
You know, they got out in time and all that. But we're thinking about everyone down in LA. And it's a tragedy. It's horrible, horrific. People lost lives and their homes and memories and everything, and including someone really close to us. So, yeah. You know, hopefully the tide will be turning soon with all the fires and all that stuff. But I'm thinking of everyone down there.
For sure.
All right. Bye.
Bye.